Well, thanks. It's always great to be here. So I'm going to talk about some work that we've done recently with Adams, McGreevy, and a couple of students, Liu and Saltman. And it's related to these earlier references. Now, a basic question about gravity in general is whether space-time topology can change dynamically. In general relativity, this would require a singular transformation. We'd have to rip the space apart one way or another. But one could imagine roughly two distinct types of topology changes. One I've labeled A here, in which one changes some topological quantum number, some quote-unquote invariance of a single connected space. More dramatically, one can also envision the possibility of transitions going beyond general relativity, which separate space into different components. So in classical general relativity, this would be singular, and we don't know what to say about it. But in quantum gravity, or even classical but string theoretic gravity, that is, regimes in which length scales are less than or equal to the string length scale, general relativity and ordinary geometry break down. And so there's a priori room for topology change to happen in a way that might be physically smooth. And there's a lot of previous work on the subject. In the context of string theory, famous examples include flop transitions, transitions changing Euler character, either classically or quantum mechanically, chirality changing transitions, flips in systems with non-zero first Chern class, and as well as older work on Euclidean quantum gravity computations suggesting topology changing transitions. What my focus here today is going to be what seems to be a new and very simple set of topology changing transitions arising in string theory, which includes two cases, one in which we change the Euler character of the bulk space, keeping it connected, as well as the same microphysical phenomenon leading to creation of disconnected components from a single connected component to start with. The arena in which I'll work, though I'll make some comments about how to generalize it later, is compactifications or target spaces of, let's say, critical string theory on a Riemann surface. So that's characterized, first of all, by its number of components. I've just drawn one here. By its genus, H, the number of handles. And let's keep track also, in the case of fermionic theories, of the spin structure of fermions on the surface. So its geometry, when GR applies, so the notion makes sense, is characterized by using diffeomorphisms to reduce the metric to some fiducial form, depending on 3H minus 3 real parameters, or complex parameters tau, complex structure moduli, as well as a conformal factor, e to the alpha, that depends on the coordinates, whose overall volume mode will play a useful role. And these complex structure deformations are very physical. They determine the ratios of sizes of the one cycles in the Riemann surface. So let's start by thinking about the basic physics of a compactification on a Riemann surface. So let's start with one component and consider first the eight-dimensional effective theory that results from descending from 10 to 8 dimensions on this Riemann surface. This effective theory has a potential energy, which I've written here in the 8-dimensional Einstein frame, for the overall volume mode as well as the string coupling. And as always, the potential energy dies to zero at large volume and weak coupling because technically of the transition to Einstein frame. And the other thing that I want to point out about this, emphasize about this, is that it's positive because of the negative curvature of the surface, and it's proportional to the Euler character, 2h minus 2, coming from integrating the curvature over that space. So if we do nothing else, if we don't add any other ingredients, such as fluxes and brains and so on, then its dynamics is relatively simple. If we start in a constant curvature metric so that these modes are the only remaining ones of interest, then the thing expands toward flat space and weak coupling. You can start it, of course, in any metric you like, and looking at this potential energy volume element by volume element teaches you that the system evolves toward the constant curvature metric in that regions of positive curvature contract while regions of negative curvature expand. So this factor in the potential energy, this factor that's proportional to the number of handles, indicates that at least energetically, if there is some mechanism for the system to lose handles, to decrease H, then that process is energetically preferred. So I've been staring at this formula for years and thinking it would be interesting to find a microscopic such transition, and we think we've seen how it works, so that's what I'm going to share with you today. Now, in other work, somewhat related, Saltman and I show that if we do add additional ingredients, fluxes and a certain kind of configuration of seven brains on, let's say, a product of three Riemann surfaces, one can perturbatively metastabilize the complex structure moduli, the volumes of the three Riemann surfaces, and the string coupling at values such that the alpha prime expansion and the quantum loop expansion is controlled. Not just large volume and weak bare coupling, but weak Tuft coupling and weak alpha prime times flux and alpha prime times curvature. We can think about embedding the processes I focus on today in this framework, but just for simplicity, I won't do that. I will instead study the system as I introduced it without any extra stabilizing ingredients, let it expand slowly in the way I just explained, and focus on a particular regime that will exhibit this stringy topology changing dynamics. I have a few slides on this model building that I just summarized, but I think I'll skip it unless there's time at the end. It's really usually takes a whole other talk to explain carefully. One thing I want to remark on, which I think is probably unnecessary here, is that although people usually consider Calabi-Yau compactifications and their supersymmetric cousins, there's actually no logical reason this is required. It's not required for consistency, for parametric control, or even for phenomenology. Even if you have faith in low energy supersymmetry in the matter sector, it doesn't imply that a Calabi-Yau starting point is required. And I think this has been complicated sociologically by the fact that in early days of string theory, people tended to impose the condition that all tadpoles canceled order by order in perturbation theory. And that gives interesting toy models to study then at each order in perturbation theory, but it's a very ineffective thing to do if you want to study things that are generic and study backgrounds where you might have a chance of fixing the moduli. So I think it's important to think critically about the assumptions that go into studying supersymmetric backgrounds exclusively in string theory. Okay, so enough of that diatribe. Now let me get back to the main subject of the talk, which is these topology changing processes that I motivated originally. So again, in this particular Riemann surface context, it's true that when all length scales are bigger than the string length, general relativity applies and there will be no topology changing processes, at least perturbatively. However, we can go to a string scale regime where the general relativistic notions break down, and we'll see that we can come out to large radius in a new phase with different topology. In particular, what I will consider is regimes of the complex structure moduli space in which either a handle is shrinking to a small circumference while maintaining flatness of the space everywhere to a very good approximation. Similarly, I'll consider a situation where a tube like what I've drawn separating two sides of the Riemann surface shrinks to of order the string scale. In both cases, because I have specified that the curvature is still small, we have control over the spectrum, and in particular, we know that winding modes around the thin tube become light. In particular, I'll consider the case with anti-periodic boundary conditions for space-time fermions around the tube. In that context, there's a minus one-half zero-point energy on the string added to the winding energy, means that the thing is tachyonic for a sufficiently small circumference. In the case of a small handle, this anti-periodic boundary condition is a choice. It's related to the choice of spin structure. In the case of this nearer factorization limit, it's not a choice. This is a trivial cycle, and the boundary conditions are automatically anti-periodic. A nice way to think about this is that in an analogous problem of Riemann surfaces as world sheets of strings, if you're talking about a vacuum diagram like this, then it's an NS state that's propagating in that tube, which has anti-periodic boundary conditions. I want to emphasize, of course, that for me, the target space is a Riemann surface, and I'm not drawing the world sheet in these diagrams. Now, generally, tachyon condensation has been argued to reduce the number of degrees of freedom. The basic idea for that is that the tachyon vertex operator in the world sheet is an exponential in time times a relevant operator in the world sheet matter sector, which suggests that when you condense it by the Zamolodchikov C theorem, the matter C function will decrease in the process. Now, there are several well-studied examples where this happens in detail. For example, in brain anti-brain annihilation, you lose the degrees of freedom of the brains. In orbifold tachyon processes that Joe and Adams and I studied, you lose the degrees of freedom at the fixed point, and so on. What we'll see is that in our case that I've set up today, a similar effect occurs, really based on a lot of standard work on the corresponding renormalization group flow. So let's get into the details now. Let's coordinatize this region of the tube that will be important, this small circumference cylindrical background, as follows. There's a theta direction around it, an r direction along it, which by t-duality we can trade for a theta tilde direction around it in the way I've drawn. Let's do the type 2 string, which has a 1, 1 world sheet theory, for which the tachyon appears as a d2 theta integral of some function t of x, depending on 1-1 chiral operators that I've indicated here. And in this setup, we've introduced very weak curvature, which means that the R dependence of the vertex operator is mild and will work in a regime where also the time dependence starts out mild, that is, will condense the tachyon as soon as it appears, which is a natural thing to do anyway. The rest of this, which will be the most important part for the initial analysis, is this cosine theta tilde times winding momentum in the operator, which will lead to this tachyon vertex operator corresponding to the interaction term in the supersymmetric Sine-Gordon theory. So the procedure to analyze this at the classical level in string theory is to take the world sheet theory and add to it this tachyon vertex operator, which in components works out to what I've written here, including pieces that came from differentiating with respect to x naught and r, as well as the piece that came from differentiating with respect to theta tilde. We can set it up to work in a regime where the former is parametrically smaller than the latter, so that the dynamics is dominated by this third term. In particular, because of the very mild curvature, there's slow time and R dependence and rapid dependence in the theta direction. So we can, to a good approximation, treat X naught and R as couplings in analyzing this theory, which is good, a good approximation for energies lower than the mass in the theta sector. So even in the full time dependent problem, we will find that this gives us control over the process. Now, those who have studied tachyon condensation processes in the past are familiar with the fact that even independent of such an argument, people often have used the renormalization group problem obtained from adding the tachyon vertex operator to the matter sector of the world sheet theory as a stand-in for the off-shell physics of string theory. And this is always an assumption, but one motivated by the fact that in string field theory, one introduces non-conformal deformations of a sort that is reminiscent of this. So in many of the analyses of earlier tachyon problems, such as Vafa's linear sigma model analysis of the orbifold case, this assumption was made, and it reproduced the results of the time-dependent problem. So for both of these reasons, I'm now going to turn to the analysis of the renormalization group flow of this world sheet theory with the addition of this tachyon operator. And as I just explained, the leading contribution is the supersymmetric Sine-Gordon interaction. So this theory is very well known, very well studied. Classically, it has an evident mass for both the elementary and solitonic degrees of freedom. In order to study the physical theory of required for the string theory problem, we need this theory in the deep infrared, which of course involves all of its quantum mechanics. And in this theory, there are strong arguments that this mass gap survives into the infrared. The physics of it is a supersymmetric generalization of the Kosterless Thallus transition, which in the bosonic case you can just prove using Fermiization at one point in the phase space. This model is integrable, and the proposed and well-checked ansatzes for exact S matrices due to Shankar and Witten and Ahn show an S matrix exhibiting only massive excitations with a mass proportional to the tachyon coefficient in our language. Finally, if you just try to think about what else it could do besides flow to a mass gap, it's highly constrained. We're starting in the theta sector with a C equals 3/2 theory, and the classification of C less than 3/2 conformal field theories is very well studied. I don't think there's an absolute proof that there are no examples without relevant operators, but all of the examples that have been studied consistent with modular invariant combinations have that property. So I'm going to take all this as extremely powerful evidence, especially the exact S matrices, that indeed this sector of the theory develops a mass gap. So the RG flow has removed the theta direction in this region of the tube where the tachyon operator was turned on, which is this thin region of the tube. Now, once theta is gone, the theory is subcritical, and there's no GSO projection that projects out tachyons. There are further tachyons, which again, if you do a Fourier expansion in the R direction, look like Sine-Gordon interactions. And those tachyons continue to appear as you reduce the dimensionality all the way down to perhaps two dimensions. So from this argument, it is evident that we, at best, are left in the middle region with some subcritical components of the target space. And indeed, we'll find direct evidence for this from an explicit linear sigma model analysis of the process. Now, there's a very physical way to study this elimination of the R direction as well in the full physical problem, including the time and R dependence. So if I go back to that potential energy I had written down and now freeze the theta sector in its vacuum because of its large mass gap, we find the resulting potential provides a barrier for penetration of the string into this region. So if we set up an S matrix computation trying to scatter through this region, we find that as the tachyon evolves, more and more energy levels are repelled from the middle region. And at the end of the process, there's complete repulsion given energies staying below the gap as the gap goes off to infinity.
I'm not quite seeing how this works. So what's the idea about why, how you get the repulsive barrier?
So the full system is this, the potential energy contribution on the world sheet, having added the tachyon, is this. The leading effect for the theta sector is this Sine-Gordon interaction, which produces a mass gap.
Yep.
So let's work at energies below that mass gap and stick it in.
R isn't in that equation.
This is a typo. So the R is down. Excuse me. You're absolutely right. This is a little typo. Okay. You know, this was there in the. So sorry. Thank you. So up here, I hope it was written correctly. Yes. Yeah. So here, the T of R's were there. I'm just sticking the theta sector in its vacuum.
Okay. And T of R was.
T of R is a slowly varying function that grows in this region.
It's
the yeah. Yes.
Okay,
a profile.
So that gets sort of enhanced, whatever the profile continuum potential.
The profile is always there, and then once we know what to do with the theta sector, we just reduce it to a. Potential in R, which is a barrier.
Right.
So if you look at the barrier in a little more detail, you see that indeed it has features suggesting the survival of this quote-unquote subcritical dust that I advertised. And again, there's a concrete reason that such things should survive. They turn out to follow from the Witten index on the world sheet, and we'll see that again. Well. From a linear model description. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting confused by something you said a moment ago. So once you get rid of the theta direction, the string becomes subcritical.
Right.
Now, usually sort of non-critical string theories, well, I think of them as having some sort of cosmological constant.
Absolutely.
But are you saying that all the massless modes become tachyonic?
I mean, I wouldn't say it quite that way, but there is a tachyon in the spectrum. The only GSO projection that's available. So there's no type 2 GSO projection that's modular invariant. There is a type 0 GSO projection that's modular invariant, and it has tachyons in the spectrum. So there's, of course, still a massless graviton as well, but
you modify the GSO projection, and you don't end up projecting at all.
Right, and you actually see that as well in this linear model. It's interesting. There's an R symmetry that corresponds to the GSO action, and as you flow, you see what happens to it, and it turns it into the type 0 case. Okay, so this is not a proof, but I think extremely strong evidence that indeed the condensation of the tachyon lowers the central charge in the target space in this way, leading to a disconnection of these two bulk regions of our original connected hyperboloid or cylindrical space. So,
Eva,
yeah.
This is similar to breaking of an Einstein-Rosen bridge. And there, it can happen, but it can't. There's always a path singularity. That is, you know, that there, like Sarhi Gubin showed, that it could happen, but you know, there was always a best singularity, you couldn't get to it.
You couldn't get to this region where the Riemann surface is.
And I was wondering, have you thought about that issue here?
Well,
okay. I mean, rather than A, the relation to Heisenberg-Rosen bridge, and B, whether or not this is something you could get to from a sensible initial state, whatever that means. Well,
you mean going arbitrarily back in time?
Right.
I have thought about it, not so much in the context of the Einstein-Rosen bridge, but I think the best thing to do here to make the past sensible is to actually embed it in the set of De Sitter models that I skipped over. Okay. Let the flux decay to where it's now not stabilized in this particular direction.
Uh-huh.
There's actually a one-loop Casimir energy that drives the complex moduli toward this place. So the past is some metastable De Sitter system, and
this is now regular and string theory, this kind of thing, right? So you have a
past. I mean the.
No, but the solution is time dependent.
The way I set it up, I was starting at a particular time where the curvature was already large, and letting it evolve, and that's perfectly valid.
Negative curvature, and if you solve negative curvature backwards, you're going to usually hit the past singularity.
That's right.
Yeah.
But
so
it could be resolved by the same kind of mechanism.
Yeah, although you're going to hit it every week. You might hit it everywhere.
Can you time reverse this solution?
Right, so this is like same question in the brain anti-brain. Formally, yes, you can. It requires a ridiculously tuned initial state. So, yes, I'll get to that question. So thank you. Keep asking questions, because I realize this is a strong statement to make, but at the level of the...
But until you get to... never really have disconnected. There's always some probability that you don't have a connected, or that things can penetrate there, except in the
side.
Good question. It's probably good at zero.
Well, it's also a question of whose time you're talking about, and we certainly haven't established here that this happens in finite time from the point of view of the appropriate observer. However, let me say a few words about that. I was going to later, but I'll do it now. You can ask the same question in the brain anti-brain system. Let's use that as a guide. In that system, you would also add an e to the kappa x naught times some operator and let it flow. In that system, we know a lot about the time-dependent solutions. There are these S-brain solutions which exhibit a phase in, so there they discuss it coming in and then going back out. Okay, and they find that the stress energy is potential energy only in a stringy scale window of time, after which it's a dust phase that people interpreted as the decay products. And I think that follows basically from the fact that the tachyonic mass is stringy. Here the scales are the same. There's a string scale, length scale and energy scale in the problem. I don't see anything that's going to draw out the process. I haven't proved it, but I don't see any reason here why it should take forever when it didn't take forever in the other cases. But it is an open question. In fact, actually, let me mention one other thing which I meant to emphasize when I first exhibited the potential energy in the problem. So it's manifest here, but let me comment on it in words. This energy density in the eight-dimensional theory is, if we work at small string coupling, which we do, is parametrically smaller than the Planck energy density. So when I keep saying that things are string scale, it's because of that. So we're not talking about producing a black brain's worth of energy density in the eight dimensions. Okay, so I want to make some more remarks on this, many of which I've alluded to already. First of all, this is, in essence, a classical process in string theory. And classically, you might have noticed that in the bulk of the space, the Witten index has jumped. I went from a cylinder to two copies of the complex plane. This is related to that subcritical dust that I alluded to. And in fact, we see that explicitly when we analyze this problem in using the tool of a gauge linear sigma model. So I'm just going to summarize our 18-page appendix on the subject here. This is a technique that was introduced by Witten, following up work of Vafa and others, in the context of Calabi-Yau target spaces. And the idea is to use a a mean field theory that's linear in the UV that flows to the target space of interest in the IR. This was then applied to tachyon problems, in particular the orbifold tachyons, very fruitfully by Vafa. And the formalism is similar. The only thing that happens is that certain parameters experience non-trivial RG flow. So for example, in the D terms of such models, one finds combinations like this vanishing with a parameter rho, which flows. So let me step back a second and explain what I'm doing in our context. So to write a linear sigma model for this process, we would like to start with one whose vacuum manifold is the initial connected cylindrical space. That would be described by an equation like this, with this parameter rho being less than zero. The same equation would describe the final space for rho bigger than zero. If you just look at this equation, you'll see that it traces out this geometry. Indeed, we find that there's a linear sigma model that includes this term, in which you can calculate, because it's super renormalizable, the direction of flow of this parameter rho, and you find that indeed it flows from left to right in this diagram, and it flows in the direction that we found already in the analysis of the physical theory, with manifest two extra vacua, which make up the difference in the Witten index, and for which one can follow the GSO projection and obtain, as is required by consistency, that what used to be the type 2 GSO projection transmutes into a type 0 1 on this set of. They appear, okay, so I realize just a summary and probably cryptic, but it's built from a deformation of a 2-2 linear sigma model, for which there's a twisted chiral superpotential with a twisted chiral field sigma appearing that multiplies, well, this is really an n equals 1 language, multiplies this quantity that contributes to the vacuum potential and whose vanishing determines the vacuum manifold. And this field sigma can have isolated vacua separate from the vacua, which are traced out by W and phi. I could go through the details with you later if you'd like, but these linear sigma models involve extra fields, which generically decouple in the IR, but which can contribute extra vacua. And you know, the Witten index works as it has to. Yeah.
So this is talking about a renormalization for flow.
That's right.
Could you just remind me again the connection? I mean, do we know that a renormalization group flow in this sense corresponds to time evolution in string theory?
So in general, we don't know, although there are many examples where it happens. Here, the statement is a little bit stronger in that we set up the problem so that when we deformed by the tachyon, the dependence of the world sheet theory on the rest of the modes, including the gravitational modes like X naught, which is essentially a gravitational mode, is weak, so that the leading contribution to the IR physics of this model does correspond to the renormalization group flow in the matter sector. This assumes that the presence of world sheet gravity doesn't change the answer for the renormalization group flow of the matter sector. So there are some assumptions here, but I think it is stronger than what you said.
But yeah. Even if you assume that, you will never really get to the other point, because the normalization group flow means every finite time evolution, there's still massive modes which remember what the starting point was. Yeah. In other words, you're not going to get good caps. Every finite time in renormalization, let's accept that we're doing renormalization group flow, every finite time, there's a thin bridge that connects the two things. It never really pinches off.
At any finite energy, it pinches off in finite time. And if you look at...
Well, we've seen what we mean by energy. warp-cheap energy or space-time energy. With warp-cheap energy, you can always go to higher and higher energies and see that it hasn't yet been stressed.
That's true, but it's also true in the brain-anti-brain case, so it's the same level of... So it's the same as asking, does a brain and anti-brain annihilate in finite time? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's if, you know, if most of the energy has gone into the decay products within a string time, as happens there, then I would describe the process as having happened. And this, I think, is going to work out similarly. But yeah, that's the one possible out that you might be able to hang your hat on here. But I do think it's similar to the brain anti-brain. So however you describe that, I would describe this the same way.
Well, when you're discussing, I mean, the case where it's most bothersome is when you're discussing a target space, which is a packed Riemann manifold.
Yeah.
And you're just pinching off handles. Then it's sort of a question. But if you're really discussing non-compact spaces, where you're creating two universes.
Yeah.
I mean, then these issues are more interesting.
I agree. I agree completely. Indeed, in the first case, there's some potential energy difference. There's, you know, it just transfers into energy in the decay products. But the fact that it's the same microscopic process in both cases suggests to me that if you're comfortable with one, you got to be comfortable with the other.
Well, it's arguments like that that then Stephen proves it.
Yeah, I know. I've been looking at the old papers, including your paper entitled "Is Quantum Gravity Unpredictable?" I think you knew what questions to ask very early on, and
information was regained, didn't
it? Yeah, I'm gonna get
to this. So.
We'll have our trip down memory lane shortly, but let me stick to the technical analysis of this case for as long as I can. If you tell me how it's different from brains and anti-brains, then I'll worry. Okay. All right. So let's play around with some more aspects of this. This is really fun. In addition to following the Witten index of GSO projection, you can follow, for example, the fate of charges in space-time. And again, this is very reminiscent of other tachyon decay processes. So in the brain and antibrains and the orbifolds, we always had this situation where there were two or more gauge groups, one of which might be Higgs, and the others of which are more mysteriously disappearing in the process. And we have that here too. Let's say we do talk now about a handle decay, then there are charges associated with fundamental strings winding around the two cycles of the handle. So those correspond to two different gauge fields, U1 gauge fields in eight dimensions. And if we condense this winding mode, then the corresponding gauge field is Higgs. While the B-cycle gauge field appears to be confined in the same way that happened in the other cases, namely, if you look at its effective action in eight dimensions, you find that as you go to this place where the tachyon decay process happens, the A cycle gauge field is weakly coupled, but the B cycle one is strongly coupled. So at least, you know, it's consistent to imagine that there's a confinement effect happening, and it would be nice to see it in more detail. Again, very similar to the other cases. We can also add fluxes. Let's say we add fluxes that are mild enough that they don't metastabilize tau away from this interesting regime, but let's say they're there. It's there in the initial state, and that's not really problematic because in the decay, what happens is that brains and anti-brains are produced on which the flux can end. Now, we can generalize this. This came out of more recent discussions with Matt Hedrick. We did here a cross-section that was in S1 with antiperiodic boundary conditions. You could do, you know, at least locally, a consistent set of initial conditions in GR, everything weakly curved and so on, but with a higher dimensional sphere cross-section. Well, the RGB problem is, again, solvable. It's just a nonlinear Zeeman model on a sphere which develops a mass gap in the IR. So it seems likely that similar things will happen with other dimensionalities.
Wait a minute. Now when the sphere gets smaller, you do have large curvature.
You do have large curvature. The RG problem, at least, is known. So if you consider a nonlinear supermodel on a sphere target space, you know what the infrared limit is. It has a mass gap, you know, including all of the higher alpha prime corrections that entails.
Don't you also have to worry about string loop corrections too, or no?
Well, the string coupling can stay small everywhere. It's very different from doing something like a big crunch, because in that case, the effective size of the space is, the whole space is decreasing, and you know, you obtain effectively a strong coupling. Here, the decay products just squeeze out the sides, and it's a very different situation.
I mean, that would be very interesting if you can do it with a sphere, because that's exactly what happened inside a black hole. The black hole interior is exactly one of these ropes pinching off. And if you know that the string sort of resolves that, then you sort of resolve the singularity inside the black hole.
Well, I want to be very careful about this. I think embedding this in an asymptotically flat space to which the decay products can escape and so on, it may be important. And that sounds very interesting. Let's pursue that. I'm just saying that I don't expect this to be a thing that's special to this particular Riemann surface setting. Okay, so let me say some words about the time-dependent process. This came up already a little bit. So the dynamical process involves generically starting from somewhere else, rolling in complex moduli toward the thin tube region. Again, this is aided by a one-loop Schirk-Schwarz, a one-loop Casimir energy that goes in that direction. As you roll toward this place, the tachyon is developing, and in the full time-dependent coupled system, particles are produced. So particles are produced because there's a time-varying mass for this tachyon. That has the effect of trapping the tachyon field at this dangerous place from which it then falls out and decays. This is a stringy version of hybrid inflation combined with the preheating phenomenon of Kaufman, Linde, and Starobinsky. So this potential energy, which I listed on one of the first transparencies, then decays into everything it can in a way that we certainly haven't kept track of in detail. One thing I want to emphasize is that this topology changing process, because it's driven by a tachyon, occurs much more efficiently than in, say, conifold transitions, because in that case, this particle production effect I mentioned just traps the field at the intersection point and does not allow it to persist through the transition. So showing that things are connected on some formal moduli space is not tantamount to it happening dynamically, as I think, you know, those authors fully realized. So that's one interesting distinction here. And I've said all this. Okay, so as has been anticipated, the case where we apply this microscopic process to a complete disconnection is particularly striking and potentially troubling. I want to emphasize that there are various different cases to which we can apply that. One is starting with two asymptotic regions and having this occur. In that case, it's like considering a quantum system with two chambers and closing the door between them. So from the point of view of one side, a pure state goes into a mixed state. But I don't know, that doesn't bother us in statistical mechanics. Actually, in your paper, you said that didn't bother you. You said that you know, you could...
Well, it didn't bother me as much as virtually.
Right, so I'm going to get, that's why I'm starting slowly.
But it's still bothering me. So, I mean, even in this case, you really, I mean, the question, there's a sharp question about whether you lose information.
Well,
you could ask at any time, And somehow you say that, you know, it's only infinitely, infinite times, couldn't you tell them? So, I mean, what sense do you...
So I'm making a distinction here between this case and a case where the second component would be compact. So in this case, there's zero amplitude to just create this infinite space. Instead, I'm just using this as a toy model for causal disconnection that's analogous to, say, De Sitter space, where similar things happen. I don't think it's any better or worse than that.
Even if one of them is compact and the other is not, there are similar problems.
Yeah, well, I'll get to that. I'm going to develop this slowly. Okay, so this is a case where they're both non-compact. There's no amplitude to just produce this, and this is the direction that it goes. And I think it's basically, in effect, a cosmological horizon that's developing like in De Sitter space. So that ship has kind of sailed, and some of us are on it. So in this case, I want to move on to the things that are even more bizarre. So let's move now to a case where, again, there's some infinite dimensions. So let's say that we have the Riemann surface be compact, but have this tachyon decay process occur everywhere in space, which is something we can set up. And once it's set up, it will happen everywhere in space. So in this case, the effective field theory, well, OK, I drew it in a more general way where I went down to four dimensions, but I think you get the idea. The space is separated because the compactification has turned into a direct sum of two components. Well, for those who have a negative response to the landscape, this might give you hope, because it means that there is a process in which we can lose the landscape is based on the proliferation of topological and flux quantum numbers. And to the extent that there's a process that prefers to separate these things out and minimize the topology, it's conceivable that this will help us simplify the discrete Schoen. It's not clear yet, but it's definitely something to consider. It also gives new meaning to the idea of unification at high energies.
Presumably have extremely long lifetimes for these processes?
Well, no, I mean, as you come down from high temperatures in the early universe, this is going to be happening. It's, so I want to talk about that later, too.
Yes. This unification at high energy, what does it mean? You do higher and fixed time, so that they're connected by a thin bridge. What do we need to do? We just have to throw in something more and more energy to tell the other spaces there?
The interesting thing, so suppose you're in this phase and you want to tell that the other space is there. There's nothing you can do by yourself. So actually, let me go back to, right? Because if we do, you need help from the other side. You get out of certain... Well, okay, let me say it precisely.
Only the solution
without... Exactly. So...
No, if it's compact, you just throw a particle in, it will go through the bridge.
No. But all she's sure of is the time reversal of the decay is...
That's right. That's right.
Like the other way of going back.
That's right.
No, but the geometry will do what it does. You throw in just one particle, it goes through the bridge, bounces around, and then it comes back out. But you really wanted the other side to be compact, right? So if it's compact, you just go in and move around.
Not before it split.
It never splits.
Never totally.
It never totally splits. And all I need to do is
high enough. I mean, that's what bothers me. It never totally splits. High enough energy.
You die high enough energy, you will explore it. So
that's like saying at high enough energy, if you...
So today we need 1 GeV, and tomorrow we need 1 TeV.
That's like saying at high enough energy, you will create brains and anti-brains. It's true, but not very relevant.
No, but I don't need to find food for that.
The question is, are there still correlation? I mean, in what sense is trace rho not decreasing?
Well, as you know, the question of a cosmological singularity can only be asked at asymptotically late times, so.
You can hide the pinched throat behind a rather small horizon, so you will think that there would not be much information at all that could be in there.
There's a related statement. Is it a topological censorship state that this kind of thing would typically be hidden behind a horizon? I don't remember the exact statement.
It's in general.
Well, it's just sort of branching off.
For these purposes, yeah. Your topology change
typically it's wrong or wrong. You cannot send a signal from one asymptotic region to the other. I think that's true.
This is string theory.
Yeah, but it's only string theory where it's actually pinching off. Other than that, it's, well.
Yes, it was just in the universe.
By the way, is there any way, can you find the topology of this?
String theory. Well, since it's not invariant, I would say no.
Well, from the beginning, is there any way? I mean, even before that, was there ever any?
Before this. I mean, at the level of this, right, well, or fully classically in string theory, you can ask about, yes, I agree, John. That's exactly, but that's part of the point here, of course, that you can't define it and it change, and so it can change and it does
the
change.
The question is, does that change really mean, but there's the other issue, I think, is one that is well defined question, is whether information is lost or not.
I agree.
Whether
so
in some quantum mechanical Gilbert space sense, you have a mixed state.
I agree. I think this setting is the strongest place to consider that, as of course, you know, in the case where it's compact, there was a argument, you know, due to Coleman and others that when you sum everything up, that doesn't happen, and that's what I'm going to get to. But yeah, so you can tell me how that development really ended, but. All I'm saying is that there is a microscopic mechanism for this to happen in string theory. All right, so the other case where we really do split off a compact space, let's say among the four dimensions, so not smeared over any infinite other directions, is the case of baby universes. And again, this is just one of the applications. Now, it happens here perturbatively in a stringy way, that's very different from the Euclidean quantum gravity computations that were done before. There were nice ones done in the context of the effective field theory from string theory by Steve and Andy Strominger. And Coleman and these guys argued that given a time reversal invariant system and a non-zero amplitude to break off a baby universe, then this process with a compact guy does not, in the end, lead to loss of coherence, but instead integration over couplings. So Coleman argued this based on effective field theory couplings between ordinary particle physics operators and effective creation annihilation operators for these universes, show that they commute, and that, therefore, when you measure couplings in the standard model, say, you project onto eigenstates of these things, which are not eigenstates of baby universe number, and that is the net effect of the process. So it's still a radical thing, but it's not a loss of coherence. In particular, they show that the entropy derived from the density matrix didn't grow with n as you kept doing measurements. Okay, so what we're interested in here is that we didn't know a priori, aside from those Euclidean gravity computations, which are rather challenging, that this happens in string theory, and now we're finding a mechanism in which it does. Okay, there are possible outs. Maybe all this renormalization group study of the supersymmetric Steingordon theory is wrong. I think that's, well, it's not a proof, but I think that's essentially impossible. And as people have anticipated, we didn't explicitly show that it occurs in finite time according to the appropriate observer. But again, I really think this is no different from the other cases of brains and anti-brains. So I think effectively it's true that it happened in finite time in the same sense that it happened there in finite time. But that would be certainly nice to get more straight. Okay. Now, I'd really be remiss if I didn't point out at this point that this physics was really anticipated in 1919 by none other than William Butler Yeats. who, so this started out as a joke for us. We thought of the things fall apart quote, and of course it works very nicely with this process, but then it turns out the entire first stanza of this poem is a description of topology change by winding tachyon condensation in string theory. It just is. The only thing you need to know is that this word, which was pronounced gyre at the time, like gyroscope, means vortex. So it says, turning and turning in the widening gyre means vortex-induced causal disconnection, the falcon can't hear the falconer, follows from tachyon condensation, in which things fall apart by the tachyon falling down, and the center cannot hold. So it creates an explosion of decay products, opening a can of worms, and I think the sociological response maybe may be well described by this. Well, okay, so Yeats had a number of other predictions based on this, which we have not yet tested. Our interpretation is that if this stimulates more wormhole discussions, this may be a good description. But so he was modeling the events surrounding World War I, but it really does apply to string theory. Okay. So
maybe
one more thing. So we can talk about these very difficult conceptual issues of what the observables are in situations where there's disconnection, and that's a great subject. You can also ask here whether there are any actual observables coming from this stuff. As we proceed down in temperature in the early universe, it would be unnatural not to consider topologies of the sort I discussed, with extra handles added, say, to Calabi-Yau's or other compactifications that you might think would be the ultimate end state. So that is a generic initial condition, and as such, you know, this process will be happening in the early universe according to that generic initial condition in string theory. So there's an interesting question of whether they can survive through inflation, et cetera, in some reasonable scenarios, and survive in late enough to decay in a way that would produce a signature. It'd be really fun if it did survive to the late universe, because when it happened, when this capping off process happened, and these caps then recoil back rapidly, it would create a correlated signal on the sky. So it's actually worth thinking about that. It's not clear that it will fit in to cosmology, but again, it's the conservative assumption is that this is going on in the early universe.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so that now I'm done.
All questions have to be asked in verse.
Maybe you sent us an instruction before I came in. Uh-huh. I mean, just the fact that you can move along moduli space of compactification, doesn't that already indicate and change topology? Makes it sort of obvious that you maybe should be able to change topology.
Oh, absolutely. So let me go back to it.
What?
About the moduli space.
So indeed, there were a number of earlier examples on the moduli space. Two comments. One is none of those involved this separation process. The second comment is that if it happens on the moduli space, it doesn't necessarily happen. I really think this moduli trapping effect prevents it from actually going on. Yeah. I mean, once you break supersymmetry enough and there's a potential, you could drive it through. Sure. No, this isn't the first example of topology change. It's just the simplest. You don't have to know what a flop is to understand that topology can change in string theory.
But you also, to counter, you're not doing string field theory either. So there's some place in a strong assumption about time and normalization rules as well. Sometimes it seems to make sense, and other times it's problematic. It might be problematic here.
I agree. But again, I would definitely invite comments on the details of the argument, because we set it up in such a way to make the renormalization group problem the leading part of the analysis, and so we think it's a real argument.
Okay. Taking it in a different direction, there was this discussion about whether disconnection happens in finite time or time. But But somebody asked about disconnection in a different sense. The mm-hmm. question before was about whether you could throw a particle of food from one side to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But that's in a different sense. So if it disconnects, and let's say it happens in some sense at finite time,
mm-hmm.
presumably there's a time growth process where it reconnects.
Right.
Now, if it reconnects, I'm guessing that it's more likely to reconnect in sort of the same place where it broke off than someplace else.
I think this model of Coleman's where it's all independent of space-time position.
Well, not really. You have to prepare a special state for
it. No, sorry, in this case, if you want to do it classically, the only, as David correctly said it precisely, the only state we know that goes the other way involves just the reverse of the disconnection process. And that
disconnects. I don't think you can. What will you do? How will you control the distance between them before they connect?
And
since the whole setup is time reversal invariant, it just underscores the fact that it never really is.
In the same sense that brains and anti-brains never really annihilate, but I think that's not a very useful way to organize it.
If disconnects, the time reverse is really connecting, and yes,
what's the distance between them before they connect?
Well, there's no, that distance loses meaning.
Of course, it's meaning. So where do they reconnect?
So, well, no, they reconnect at a certain time in the two universes, so to speak.
I mean, this. I think I do too. Which is let me point you to a case you know well, which is the world sheet theory of a string. Okay, there you have separation and reconnection processes. They make sense. We know how to formulate that. In that case, these A and A daggers are integrated vertex operators.
Yeah.
In the world sheet theory, it's what we do, and it's sensible, and they really do disconnect. So
most importantly, the string is a compact surface, right? If I have two non-compact universes that disconnect, I have no way to understand how there could be a normalizable probability for it to reconnect, which is to be uniform across the space. Really, there must be a preferred point.
I don't. So let's go back to this picture.
Let me try my answer.
Good.
In some sense, whenever we talk about space-time in string theory, we're assuming some low-energy semi-classical description to have an ordinary familiar-looking space-time. So I think in that sense, that our space-time is this low-energy semi-classical approximation, you're right, it simply splits. But Nadi's also right that in a more complete description of what's happening, there is always some very high-energy process. I mean, if you think of this tachyon condensing, there's always some very high-energy processes which could connect them. But you just wouldn't see that in the usual low-energy.
Exactly.
And in particular, even like in that case, you still have a pure density matrix. So those correlations, the off-diagonal elements, are still there, maybe only seen in these very high energies. It's not easy to see in that.
Well, it seems like ultimately there could be two answers to it. Maybe it splits in finite time in the Cole theory, and maybe it doesn't. Right? There's a calculation that one could imagine doing, but it's probably extremely hard to do. If it does split, then we've got to find a way of describing it. It's going to be this whole third quantization sort.
But
given that the topology you make has no definition anyway, I mean, it's hard to imagine there's a well-defined meaning to the topology.
Because your transitions between all the things.
No, it really depends whether those transitions start with a one Hilbert space and decompose it into sort of two. That's what I would think splitting meant. There are no operators that connect the two.
In the first quantized version of understanding D-brains, as Joel and Kunz a long time ago, do they have some of the topologies from the worldship point of view that really disconnected the world? Riemann surfaces boundary, they have to be all summed up together. That's not what we do.
I think everybody agrees that in two-dimensional gravity that happens.
It's the third quantized version.
Well, in two-dimensional gravity on the string world sheet, that's the answer. You can view it as the world sheet or view it as a toy model of gravity, and it happens. So, I think that, you know, the fact that there's a time reverse process doesn't in itself prohibit this from happening. And again, if you believe brains and anti-brains never annihilate, then I agree this never happens. But
the sense in which there's not topology, presumably the same sense in which there's not topology in field theory when you're talking, you know, Feynman diagrams are just an approximation to the theory, and their topology is an approximation.
There's one difference with the brain on brain. There, the energy, the localized energy in the region of the brain on brain is gradually disappearing. And they never really disappear to zero because it's an exponential process. It's not a little bit of energy remains there. But that's not disturbing. Having a little bit of energy which keeps going down.
That's the same here.
The whole
universe disappears. No. It's the same here. So go back to this basic process.
So it never happens that the entire energy in the brain on tape brain goes to zero at that point.
So, sorry, let me just try and answer your question and see how you... So the energy that used to be in this handle is now going into the modes that arise after this process. So, you know, this potential energy that I wrote down is decaying into gravitons and even massive string modes and so on. And we set it up precisely to be localized, to have control over the asymptotics. And
not what I was saying. The brain after brain also never really decayed to zero. It decayed to very, very low energy density, but never exactly to zero. And the analogous thing here is this thing never splits.
So you're agreeing that it's similar to the brain and anti-brain.
Right, but I think the direction I take from the similarity is exactly the opposite. So yeah, the brain after brain also never decays to zero. Any finite time with a little bit of energy density.
It's true, but I don't find that very useful. I think, for example,
the brain after brain, it's not useful, but here it is useful.
It may be useful here when we get to these questions of are we officially, you know, turning into a mixed state? But for the question of whether the internal space looks more like, you know, a space with, you know, an extra handle versus a space without the extra handle, it's quite clear that within a string time, it has a spectrum and interactions of a space without that extra topology, despite the fact that there's a little bit of energy dissipating still.
If you were doing an experiment,
yeah,
so you have this, you imagine this time-dependent process going on.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you're doing an experiment.
Uh-huh.
So you have to look at the whole thing,
right.
Experiment and the universe.
Right.
You send in a very high energy probe. Presumably, it could, you know, in effect, stabilize, go through the neck, bring the neck.
So what are you imagining? You put in enough energy that it goes back up?
I'm trying to observe whether, you know, that something split over there. Well, actually, you have, in all your cases, it's sort of everywhere.
Again, it depends.
So anyway,
it depends.
So I shoot in a high energy beam.
Mm-hmm.
And that could stabilize the process from happening. It certainly affects the energetics of what's going on in this finite volume.
I mean, you might be able to kick it up the hill again.
Yeah, and get through it.
Or it might accelerate it, too, by more energy flow.
I'm just saying,
that's true.
This is a local thing that's happening.
Yes.
So if I try to observe it, it'll affect it.
Right, if you observe it with too high energy at first, you could kick it back up the hill, I agree.
Well, I have to observe it too high energy because I'm looking at a very small region. So, you know, a big...
Well, you can send the S wave through, so to speak. You can send in this, you know, well, okay.
No, but that's actually, that's the argument. Whatever I send,
we'll
receive.
No, that's right. That's right, but all that we need for this dimension is that it'd be about string scale, whereas, you know, the tachyon VeV is growing. So I just need energies less than the tachyon VeV for it to be repelled. And as the tachyon keeps growing, even if I send in string scale energy but not scaling up with the tachyon, it gets repelled. So
Yeah, but I can always do an experiment. This, you know, this would be something that would be sort of happening at every point in space, at every point in time. And if this was time, it's been dust in space. If I could sort of try to observe it, then it would happen.
You might be able to. I'm not sure about whether you can do it by just coming in from one side or not, for example.
Well, high enough energy you have to be able to, because otherwise I could lose my probe, could disappear to the other universe.
And how do you know that doesn't happen?
Well, I can't lose energy. So if I put in more energy than what's being released, it's okay.
I would actually like to talk about that more slowly, because as another time-dependent process is, again, you're doing something on top of an already time-evolving process, and it's not clear that energy is conserved or whose energy we're talking about.
Well, you might just get more energy back, and, you know.
I mean, you scatter some back.
Gravitons or whatever they come out.
Yeah. I mean, this may be, but I think just as in De Sitter space, it's not clear what the right notion of energy is. I mean, I did, motivated in part at the start by the fact that the potential energy drops if you lose a handle, but that's in the, that applies to the case, which is a little less bizarre, where it's.
Maybe in the interest of getting to cookies in a finite time, we should close.
Thank you.